Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellero, and this week my guest is Andrew Stone of Stone Design. You know him from his infamous or famous software and legendary software, the Twitter app called Twiddlator. Andrew, good afternoon. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
It's nice to have you. I've been told that you are should be very high on my list of people to interview. And so I couldn't wait to get you on the show. And I've heard so much about you in the past, and we did an interview with you at WWDC before, and you're just legendary in the community, and it's really great to have you on the show. In fact, Will Shipley has described you as the godfather of the indie developers. I wanted to chat with you about that, how you got into that place.
Well, that goes back a ways. And you can't get to be an indie until you just start, like everybody else. I was so fascinated with computers back as far as Star Trek as a little kid. And when the Mac came out, I was already fooling around with your TRS-80 and your IBM PC, which had so much advertising, but I saw a Mac and I'm like, wait a minute, this is the cool thing. This is really spectacular. And since I was trained as an architect and a builder and had spent the first 10 years of my career doing solar design build, basically passive solar Adobe homes and things like that.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Yeah.
So, I mean, I, like all of us, the computers came at a certain time in our life, whether you were 12 or whether you were 30. And seeing that the Mac was like, oh my, does this mean I can get rid of working drawings and just do them on the computer? And the professional quality of your architectural drawings is just so so much better when it's done by a machine compared to by hand, that I was really taken. And not only that, but I started enjoying the computer more than doing the work of building and designing. And
that's the bug.
That's the bug.
What app were you using for that?
Well, so really, like, you know, everybody, you know, now we have time to look back on everything. I can tell you the day when the bug was given to me, and it was given to me directly. It's kind of like a Buddhist tradition where the master must give the student the medicine. And in this case, it was Bill Atkinson, who I didn't know who he was. Here's this guy. I didn't know enough about the Mac at Macworld to really know about the legendary characters that had created the Lisa and the first Mac. But Bill had been off on a special mission to create something that would allow regular program and regular people to actually program the Mac, and that was called HyperCard. And so this demo of HyperCard that he gives at Macworld had a room full of people not only salivating, but it had me in particular thinking, I want to write software like that. Heck, I want to be that guy. I want to have as much energy and enthusiasm as Bill does. And
isn't it amazing how simple things like that back in the 80s that we look back on now and kind of laugh about were so inspiring and so cool at the time?
And that's the thing. You know, we, you and I, we are always at the crux, or we're at the position of the next new thing. And so even though it was that back then, the kids of today should never forget that the new next big thing is just around the corner too. So anyway, here's HyperCard, and it is the gateway drug to computers, honestly, because for the first time, non-programmers can just simply draw objects into a card. Some people even say that HyperCard was the beginning of the internet, because things linked together and it was about information and about people from a wide range of expert domains producing content using this amazing tool that did not require a programmer. Now, I have a great quote for you, and this is about Inside Macintosh. And this was the barrier to entry in programming the first Mac. The only way you could get documentation for programming the Mac was the Inside Macintosh, these gigantic telephone book. And they were just, well, here's the quote. Kathy Spracklin said, "Inside Macintosh consists of 25 chapters, each of which requires that you understand the other 24 before eating it."
Sounds a little recursive to me.
So it was scary, but HyperCard had this little backdoor into native programming called X functions. And so at first you're just scripting, but now you want more power. You want to get to the heart of the Mac. And that was really sort of my first experience with programming in Pascal, the language that we were using back then, in Lightspeed Pascal and then Lightspeed C.
I remember that. Was that Mr. Mark, Dave Mark, who wrote that?
Lightspeed C? So these are all these great tools that – and, you know, for each evolution of the tool, more and more people were able to program the Mac. And, you know, if we're going to talk about the whole arc, but the arc has taken us today where, you know, Xcode, it's practically doing it for you. And it's fabulous to see the tools we've built over the last 25 years to allow us to do this.
It is. I wanted to hear about how that took you into the world of Steve Jobs and Next.
Right. So I'm writing HyperCard stacks. I'm getting hired to write them for others. I did some chapters in the Tricks of the HyperTalk Masters. And so all of a sudden I'm going, hey, maybe I can make money off this. And that was when that March of 1989, when two young men dressed in suits and little white shirts and thin black ties, I didn't know whether they were Mormon brothers or what, but Steve had sent out his emissaries to all the universities to demo the Next Cube. And as you all remember, in 1986, Steve was forced out of Apple by John Sculley, and off he went to form the next new thing. And that's why he called it Next. And by 1988, it's ready to tell the people about, but it's 1989 before actual external developers are allowed to get their hands on the machine. So I am so impressed. I'm so taken with this that I realize this is my chance to get on. I'm thinking back at the time. Well, the spreadsheet's been written and the data, you know, I figured that all the major software that would ever be written was already written. So I guess I missed out. So I just want to tell young developers.
Too late. 1989. It's too late.
It was too late. But so within weeks of getting my machine, we go down to camp in Redwood City.
Now, did you have to pay full price for that?
Absolutely full price.
Wow. Well, it was about $5,000 or $6,000, wasn't it?
No. I'm gonna blow your mind. You had to be a fanboy because listen, it was $10,000 for the computer.
Oh my.
$2,000 for the printer, and the additional $2,000 for camp, 5 days of training in Redwood City at the mothership, the mini mothership at that time.
Class.
And so it turns out that much money then, $14,000, is around $28,000 of today's money. Oh, so, well, that was a time when software, remember, I was charging $800 a seat for our database that we built for Steve, which I'll tell you a little bit about. So here I am. I'm at camp, and I had already read all the documentation before going to camp because I figured, gosh, those guys in California, I live in New Mexico, they must be so smart that I don't want to fall behind. So I read the docs. So I was ready to actually start coding day one, and I built this like a type styler. So you can make really cool groovy text using the display PostScript, mm-hmm. which the Next had in basically pioneered. And the idea here was simply whatever you saw, you could render at any size because it was vectors and then being rasterized. What this meant was what you saw on the screen would be what you saw in the printer. And back then there was usually a large discrepancy between the two. So the Next had really, to anybody who loved software and who loved what was happening, they knew that the Next really combined the best of the secure Unix platform with the best of the Mac UI. And so since I wrote this app very quickly, it immediately came to the attention of Steve, and we were called out there to demo it to him. Now, I don't think I've ever been quite that nervous. And I remember that in those days, the Hawaiian shirts of Apple had been replaced by business suits. So I was dressed to the T with a Windsor knot and everything. And Steve comes into the room, and he goes, "Oh my God, this is great. You should charge $49 for this." And I go, "Steve, the media on which I have to ship it out to people costs me $49. Because the only way the only floppy for a Next computer was a giant optical disc.
I remember those.
And because he loved it, he basically asked us to, and by us I mean my partner, Chris Jensen. She was the president of the Applekirky, our local Mac users group. And she and I just, she had a background in computer science as well. So together we designed the database called Datafile. And Steve promised us it would make a lot of money, and it did. And this is all early before, being there first. There's got to be said something about, you know, being there first. And I tell you, I have only had the experience of touching the future physically twice in my life. And the first time was the day that Magnesium Cube arrived here in New Mexico. And the second time was in 2012 in December 8th when my Tesla S arrived. Mm. It's the same. Now, how could I have gotten from one to the other? Well, it's definitely connected. Because the whole journey of Next really was it was something that it was a very hard time for Steve, and the reason was this: the technology was there, but all of the Mac developers were doing fine on the Macintosh, and they had no incentive to leave and join Steve in this new world of object-oriented programming. And so in that regard, Steve was kind of sad that he had to work with a whole new cast of characters, meaning the crazies that were willing to, you know, bet their life savings on this new platform. However,
a new breed of customers too, right? Universities and the government.
Well, it was a moving target. So it started out, basically, yes, it was going to be the universities, CMU, all the – and I forgot about the government part, but you're right. That's exactly right. The NSA had an interest in it because they were developing the dual elliptical encryption at the time. And so – what was really interesting is that all the major universities that were into cybernetics and software definitely, you know, got into the next. What this meant was within a short order, the community of the people using Next were some of the smartest folks on the planet. And this is at a time actually before the birth of the internet, because that happens on the Next a few years later. But, you know, we're all using UUCP mail, which basically there was a time when the internet was really consisting of the computers that we had in our, you know, offices. And the Next, for example, we were running send mail off of the Next machine. So the first Rev 1 of the internet really were folks using the Next and other Unix machines, making it possible for mail to be sent. And that was a time when if I wrote Dijkstra or I wrote anybody in the world in computer science, they would write you back personally. There wasn't spam then.
Right.
That was a later invention.
It was amazing. The first one I ever saw was at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in one of the scientist offices. And he was still running it in 1995 or so, and he loved it.
Right. Oh, yeah. Because you could do all of the stuff that required a Unix platform as well as have a nice UI. And some of the new productivity software that people like Stone Design and Lighthouse Design wrote for the Next. So the thing that we did have going for us in that time was that we felt we being everybody involved with Next, either there actually were really only maybe 50 engineers and maybe 50 people in sales. It was not a huge organization. And there were really only about 50 external developers. So you can fit the entire, you know, world, the inside of the Next world in a very small room. And everybody really does know each other. Steve made it a point that there was a glossy magazine, Next World, that, you know, would cover, just like Macworld was covering the Macworld, Next World, also an IDG publication at the time, was meant to really highlight everything around the platform. Well, when it's such a small little community like that, pretty soon everybody's starting to know each other. And there was something about the feeling that, wow, here's this great genius who is got the right idea. But you know what? He's going to need a team to take him to the next place. And, you know, whether or not people thought about it consciously, it was about kind of, I hooked my star to Steve. That's as simple as that. And I gave it my all, and I gave my loyalty, and that loyalty was rewarded. And there was nothing like 2010, maybe 2011. Anyway, I had a problem. I dropped Steve a line. Problem solved. Now name a major corporation in the world where you can do that.
Cool. It must have made you feel really good when Steve was back into Apple again and had the financial backing of a large company.
Right. In a way, we felt like that was the deliverance, that we were the ones who, like, we're like blowing on the ember of the coal of the, you know, that is that spark that is going to bring humanity to the next level, that's going to allow the individual to have as much say as people with much more capital and resources, that it's going to democratize our existence and allow people to work from home. It's such a big draw. I mean, as a architect builder, that had been my life. I work from home. I'm not about to, Mark Twain reminded me, never take a job that requires new clothes. So this was good.
Steve, when Steve sprang back on the scene, then that's sort of like the beginning of our consciousness, our renewed consciousness of Steve and his leadership at Apple and resurrecting Apple and using the next technologies to do that. Before we go on, though, Andrew, I need to take a short commercial break. Stay with me. We're just going to do a little 60-second short commercial here with Kelly. And then we'll be right back. And then I want to switch to talking about the modern day and Twitter and all the things you've been doing. Folks, we'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we are back. Andrew.
Yay.
Hey, that was Kelly Gamont. She's with the Mac Observer now, and she's fabulous.
Can I just say one thing about the Mac Observer? You guys have been such champions of helping people understand that privacy versus security and the role that each, you know, what do we want? Brian Chafin wrote an excellent article this week called Don't Trade Your Privacy for Nothing. And I mean, that's so important because as people in technology, we may understand issues. I've been working with the NSA since 89. They were big consumers of the data file database. And so, you know, when their mission gets watered down, or because they were oddly given two missions, one, protect, two, surveil, they're in a really rough position around that. But I think it's really important for people to understand what the Apple difference is. And kudos go to Tim Cook as well for helping to explain in almost kindergarten-like terms to the general public why it is that, you know, if, you know, your banking won't be secure if there's backdoors in encryption.
Right.
So, you know what? That's always a recurrent theme whenever we talk about technology. And here is the basic, to me, the basic schism is this, which is the Steve vision is that computers will bring liberation to humans through understanding of other cultures, through being able to be super productive, regardless of what resources you might have. You can probably access a cell phone and do something productive. And sort of the interest of a few to control. And this is a dynamic that is just being highlit every day. Though, you know, when power is kind of collected in places, it's hard to wrestle it away from those places. And this trend is something that concerns me. And we'll get back to this towards the end of the interview because I think it's critical for us all.
Yes, it is. And thanks for your compliments on TMO. We do our best. Brian's a great writer. So here we are in the modern day, and Next is gone, and Steve's back with Apple, and Apple's doing swimmingly. And somehow you've gotten into this thing called Twitter.
Well, let's rewind to April 2008. The iPhone's been out for 9 months, but it wasn't open. So there was absolutely – it's like, how does that affect me? I'm a developer. So in April 2008, Steve goes, we are not only opening it up, but we're launching this thing called the App Store in July. You have 100 days to kick some butt, write some apps. And I tell you, it was just like the very beginning when I was working on Create TextArt and Datafile for Next. We're at the beginning of something tremendous and something new. So in those 100 days, I wrote two very, really great apps that are very, you know, very deep apps. Like one is iGraffiti, and it just lets you draw different brushes and stuff and paint over photos. And there's been a bunch of apps like that since then. And the other was Talking Pics, which allowed you to take pictures and audio and weave it into like a web log and then press a button and, you know, export it to a web page. Now, those apps, it turned out that I was still thinking desktop. People want features. No, it turns out that that wasn't quite right. Well, anyway, I got done with those apps and we're waiting. We got about 20 days left. What am I going to do? Well, I noticed that Twitter had sort of become a popular thing because a few months earlier, there'd been a protester in Egypt who had sent out a tweet, "Help, I'm in jail." And within moments, his family is coming to help him. And I realize, oh my goodness, this could be a great tool for, you know, citizens who want to speak their mind or whatever. And so I made a first Twitter client. I called it Twittilator. And that version one was funny because it had a giant emergency button on it. And when you press that button, it would tweet out, "Help, I'm at," and it would give your location.
Is there a story behind the name Twittilator?
Remember, I had already written Vidiator and Imaginator. We have the Terminator. And then, and then there's sort of something about the ego nature of social media. You're twiddling your thumbs, you know? So that's how it kind of evolved. And I'm in line at the Apple store for the iPhone, and people are going, dude, your app is blowing up. It's the only free Twitter app that doesn't have commercials in it. So that was the thing. And before too long, we realized, well, we'll make a free version and have a pro version at the cost of $5, you know, for, you know, upgrades almost forever, whatever. So that notion of monetizing Twitter really occurred to the developers because when we're here, you have to remember, it's at the very beginning, Twitter was just sort of a web page that you could go to send a message. But now here come mobile phones, and so Twitter becomes really fun when you come up with new ideas. Twittilator was the first app to be able to enter emojis, which were really hidden into the iOS at the beginning. And it was the first app to allow you to take video and upload video. And we had partnerships with about five organizations that had link shorteners, and right. It was really a mashup of all the stuff that was going on around Twitter. And we were in this, I would call it it was almost like an arms race between Twitterific, Tweetbot, Tweetbot's later. It's like Echo Phone, Twitterific, and Twittilator. So if we come up with a really innovative new idea, like the idea of retweets and all that, Twitter didn't come up with that. Those were all done by third parties. And so the thing that Twitter failed to recognize when the big money came in and they said, "Hey, we got to make money," is that it was really, you know, Lauren Brickner and me and Craig Hockenberry and a few other developers who were pushing the envelope of what these mobile apps could do. And so we had a great run. But then little by little, the Twitter management kept making mistakes they kept thinking that they didn't need these third-party developers. They definitely hadn't studied, you know, Apple and understood how in times of need, when you go to WWDC and there's not that many developers, you remember the lean years.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have espresso carts and sushi. Apple really understood treating developers with respect. And that was something that Twitter, with the new money and people who hadn't been in tech for a long time, didn't understand. There's only a limited pool of really excellent talent, and you don't want to be pissing those people off. And so they've continued to make – let me just read something that that Jack Dorsey, their CEO, said at the developer conference a few weeks ago. Somewhere along the line, our relationship with developers got a little complicated. Our relationship with developers got confusing, unpredictable. We want to come to you today and apologize for the confusion. He'd like to reset the relationship, he said, but it's not clear how. And what he missed was that humans who run on wetware don't have a reset button. And if you poison the well, then there's no way you're going to get back. And that goes back to that key of loyalty. And the thing that Steve understood, and those of us who stayed and stuck with Steve through thick and thin, were able to, you know, walk away saying, I feel good because anybody can be with a winner, but when it's things are hard, did you stick it out? And that's a really
valuable lesson for our listeners.
And so the Twitter thing was a most beautiful bookend to my success at the beginning with the Next, you know, being able to sell tons of software early, being able to invest that in, well, when Apple stock and Starbucks and things like that, things I believed in. That allows me today to have my other bookend of Twitter later and all that success. And because of some things that have happened recently since the Edward Snowden releases, it's really time for me as a elder to do more of what I started doing when the iPhone first shipped. I started a little coffee group every Thursday morning. And this is a cool thing that is very much scalable to any community. There are developers everywhere now. But once a week on Thursday mornings, we get together at a coffee house. And nowadays, it's turned into almost pure philosophy club. And between physics and particle physics and you name it, we're talking about it. But the one thing we do is we help people vet their ideas. We help set up teams for people. And, you know, honestly, it's just fun to help others succeed now. For example, Bandojo is a very interesting music app I helped a guy bring to the platform. And it's sort of like, you know, a story. A story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I would never trade the 25 years that I gave to that world. But that world is it's just a piece of the bigger world. And as an elder, I really feel more compelled to, for example, work with the New Mexico State Legislature to help them understand issues around, anything that is about our liberty. I mean, you're in Denver, right?
Right.
So you understand the new liberties. And here we're just trying to organize around decriminalizing cannabis as a first way to at least remove the harm done to society. And the other things that really compel me now is, I don't know if you know this, but Albuquerque is Tamalewood, and Breaking Bad was filmed here. And so when Better Call Saul came up to be filmed, I go, what is this cool thing about being an extra? So I went way outside my box and submitted a headshot, and the second episode of Better Call Saul, you'll see me in jail.
Awesome.
In jail. 2 seconds of me grabbing the bars and nodding.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, Andrew, we're starting to run out of time here, and so I wanted to kind of just finish up. Do you have any final words of sage advice for young developers you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think the main thing is it doesn't matter if you have a background in architecture and building. Software can be your new home, and what makes great software engineers are people that have a multiplicity of talents. And at this point, a software team is no longer the lone wolf programmer. Instead, it's a group of talented people who rely on the guy who knows code to do the code. Maybe you're the Photoshop whiz. And I think what's really exciting to me is that the true significance of Steve's last name is really manifested on the planet. There are literally millions and millions of people with jobs because of him. And I think that for me, I just find that it's a natural place to act. I do an iOS workshop too, twice a month, where we let whoever wants to come bring in your app. We will take it to the next step for you or with you. And just to do this on a pro bono basis to help create economic development in an otherwise fairly depressed New Mexico. We just have not had the recovery that other states have had. And as a result, you know, we need more startups. We need more great ideas. And I'm always happy to encourage people with their ideas. And I feel like for me, honestly, getting back to the gardening, back to the solar, back to the stuff that I started out with. I mean, and the coolest thing is that architecture now is a process of software, because we're using concrete 3D printers that print concrete, and all of the robotics in a modern day house. It's sort of like this weird confluence where you have two careers, they're very disparate, and then by the end of your second career, now those two careers are, you know, inextricably linked.
Yes. Yep. Yep. That's amazing. This is an amazing story you've told. It's been quite a story arc. And thank you very much for sharing this story with us. The listeners are going to be delighted to hear this. Thank you so much for being on the show, Andrew. We're just going to have to wrap it up. So thanks again. It's been an amazing journey, and thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you, John.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show too. Thank you for coming by. We always enjoy having you with us, and we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.